My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. My group is a Markham Village group in Markham, Ontario. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor, and I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the committee so very much for having me here. It's such an honor and a privilege to come here, and I just don't have the words to say how grateful I am for all the work that goes into something like this. I mean, really, it's an amazing weekend. I mean, and the quality of the speakers that we've heard so far. And do you not think it's just a wonderful job they've done here? I think so. I would also like to thank Alexa, who came to pick me up at the airport. And, you know, she was so gracious, and she's so beautiful, and she was so young and willing. You know, and I just wanted to destroy her in an instant with But thank you, Alexa. You're just a delight and really lovely. So that's my sponsor shouting at me. And so tonight I'm going to do steps one and two. You know, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 40 years old. It was Edmonton, Alberta. I had nothing left. I thought that nobody in the world ever drank away all the stuff that I drank away. Because my alcoholism, there were certainly other alcoholics where I used to be, but there certainly wasn't a fellowship. There certainly wasn't a camaraderie. When you got to my stage of chronic alcoholism, there was nothing left but loneliness. And you did not want to share that with anybody because there was no way to let anybody in. But I thought to myself also, why did it take me so long to get here? Why did I not get here before? And an old timer said to me, you get it when you get it. And I said, yeah, but I've lost everything. Why was this not? And he said to me, there's no answer to that question. Just be here. And eventually, things will happen for you. To admit I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable. If I thought back about that, you see, alcohol was what gave me power. Alcohol was what made my life manageable. Because from I was very young, life was not manageable for me, long before I ever took a drink. Life was very difficult. You know, very much like Bill Wilson when I read his wonderful essay, This Matter of Fear. Bill describes in there all the things I felt when I was young. He talks about the horrendous fear that kept him separated from people and how eventually that fear became aggression. He talks about the panic attacks he had when Bertha died, which I experienced at age 13. He talks about his fear of death and his obsession with death. I had all of that. I mean, I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. Because I was always looking for understanding everywhere I went. And there was no understanding. I did not know that my solution would be a glass of alcohol. I did not know that alcohol would give me what Dr. Silkworth promised in the big book. He said, when men and women drink, they get a sense of ease and comfort. You see, that was what I needed all my life. But I didn't want to drink because, you see, well, Ancestry.com just told me recently that I am 98% Irish and Scottish. And 2% English. Which means, you know, it's like You know, those the Irish and the Scottish were always wanting to drink, and the English part was always trying to lecture them, and it was just one part of me sitting in judgment, and the rest of them just going crazy. My old grandfather drank, but he drank on weekends. And I remember when he had these horrendous hangovers. And I used to say to him, I used to hear him quote Shakespeare. He used to say, you know, when in disgrace with fortune and wind's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate. And I used to say to him, what does that mean? He says, it's talking about a man who had secrets. Talking about a man who did things he didn't want anybody to know about. Don't ever, ever get there. But I was to get there. When I drank at age 25, I was living in Jamaica. And the situation all around me, I tried everything in my life up until age 25. I had tried careers. I had tried moving around the UK. I tried getting married, having a baby. I tried all these things. And at age 25, my life was dropping apart. I was dropping apart from the inside. And somebody gave me a glass of rum. 151 proof rum. Is there anyone here who has had that magical experience? Said Bob. That's all I can describe it as. Magical. Magical. It was transformational. You know, I did not drink to get high. If it had made me, I didn't need to get any higher. You know, I was born on high alert, you know. I just needed a little bit of shush. I just needed something that would remove the barriers from the rest of the world that I had been walking around with for 25 years. Let me belong. Let me in. Let me get out of my head. My head's killing me. I never stop thinking. I'm going mad. I was going mad. And I had a few drinks. That's the solution. So how can something that produced that turn against me? Now, I don't know it's turning against me. Because from I had my first drink at 25, I drank every day. Because I had found my solution to living in a reality where I didn't fit. Alcohol changed my interaction with the rest of the world. It made everything okay. I never liked people. No, I was afraid of people. And like Bill, when I was young, that fear turned to aggression. You know, I don't look like it now, but I was a fighter. And if you didn't smile at me, I'd hit you. And I just didn't, I mean, even, I remember my first sexual, it wasn't sex for me, he was trying to have sex, and I wasn't interested because I was too busy thinking about myself. And I remember saying to him, at the height of his passion, so what do you think about death? And he said to me, I think you should go home now. So alcohol somehow dissolved the barriers. I wish I could replicate for you the transformation that came about in me. Because now I love people. Now I love interactions. Now I love parties. Now I am free. Now I feel just like you look to me. But as it says in our book, this great gift that we have, that women go down the road quicker than men. And after about 4 years, I was over that invisible line. I think that's what you call it, because that's when I noticed I had my first shakes. I remember it vividly, sitting in a restaurant in Jamaica with some friends of mine, about to pick up a glass of wine, and my hand shaking, and I can't pick it up. And I wonder now how I'm going to get this liquor down, because I need it. I need it. I hadn't had a drink before I went to meet them, and I need it. And from there, it just got worse. And I remember one morning waking up beside my husband in Kingston, Jamaica, and I woke up in the morning, and there was a half glass of rum on my chest. None of it spilled. I'm sleeping with this half glass of rum on my chest. And he said to me, "Do you think you're drinking too much?" I said to him, "What's too much?" Because I didn't know. And nobody knew. All people knew is that I was beginning to change. The change that was coming about now was a reverting back to my old ways. A reverting back to being hostile with people. To not liking being in crowds. To just wanting to be alone a little bit. And then the morality slipped. And I started doing things I shouldn't have been doing. And causing a lot of trouble. And a lot of pain. And I have two little boys. Now that is a great conundrum for me. I have two little boys that I love more than anything in the world. And yet I can't stop drinking. And eventually, I don't know if this is just a mantra that plays inside the alcoholic mind. But I thought if I get a divorce and leave this husband and go to another country, it's going to be different. But you see, I was to find out that we keep changing people, places, and things, but the thing that has to change is us. And I did not know that. So I left the island with my boys, and you know, I did everything. I married another man. He took me to Canada. I thought, this is wonderful being here. Drink Canada dry. Here I come, you know. This time is going to be different. And it only got worse. I don't know if there's anyone here from Alberta. Thank you, guys. Owe you my life. But way back in the day, my territory was southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia, and I was a blackout drinker on the road. That was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. I've got two little boys because I've sent that second husband away, because that's what I do. I use people. He's telling me about my drinking. He has to go. And I've got these two little boys that I want to keep fed. I want to keep dressed. I want them to get their football clothes. I want them to get everything the other kids are getting, because they don't have anybody in the family in Canada but me. I'm a hopeless drunk. The nightmare of that time in my life, when I'm trying to do all the right things as a mother, all the right things as an employee, and I'm leaving one place and waking up in Grand Prairie, or someplace else, Red Deer, Alberta, wherever. And I don't know how I got there. And I know I'm going to have to head back home because I forget where I've left my boys. Who did I leave my children with? I can't remember. But I have to get a bottle of vodka to drive back. And when I drive back, I don't know where I am. And I don't know where my children are. And the horror of alcoholism that Billy spoke about so beautifully. You see, when Bill spoke, I identified with every bit of his journey. Every bit of it. Because this is a horrendous illness. And we forget about that. You know, this step one that we have here, We owe it to the people who are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous today to qualify them, to make sure that they be alcoholic, to make sure. Because there are people, in, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, that are trying to redefine the word alcoholism, the illness alcoholism. I spoke to somebody the other day who said to me, she was an A, and she said, well, I never liked alcohol. I took my alcohol in powder form. That poor girl is in the wrong fellowship. We kill people. Bill Wilson said that we cannot be all things to all people. That is why, too, this is the only thing that has ever worked for us. That is why we have a singleness of purpose. It is so important. We don't do that to be unkind and to be cruel. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was very fortunate, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. I'll just finish you on a journey with the worst thing in the world that still today I don't think anybody understands. That was eventually going back to Jamaica, losing my children, having suicide attempts, ending up with alcoholic poisoning, having been in detox, having DTs. They're fun. Watch them walking around in the wall, wherever they are, and hearing beautiful music when there's nothing where it's coming from. Auditory hallucinations. I won't go into my life down at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach because it was the dark night of the soul. The humiliation, the degradation, the despair, the loss of my femininity, the loss of my humanity, the loss of everything of value in my life. And I don't even have any words to describe to you the agony I felt. Knowing that I'm there because I can't stop drinking. Because there's no solution for me. Because if I stop drinking, then I'm going to go mad. Because alcohol is what stopped me from going mad in the first place. So I'm between a rock and a hard place. And there's nothing else for me to do but drink myself to death. That's it. That's the only, there's no other solution for me. And my old aunts came through this wonderful God and some coincidences. You know, we say in AA, coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous. And I went back to Canada and couldn't stop drinking, got married again. No, I love getting married. I just don't have any follow through. You know, I love the ding-a-ling-a-ling, the magic. He thinks I'm exciting. Till I try and kill him. Not my fault. And there was a wonderful psychiatrist called Dr. Milliken in Edmonton. And he treated me for 4 years. He treated me as a manic depressive. And he treated me on lithium. Lithium and another thing called, I can't remember what it was, but not at all. And I loved being institutionalized. You know, they called me a retread. You know, because alcoholics of my type, that's eventually where we end up. We end up in the asylums, the psychiatric wards. And I love being in there because I get oblivion compliments of the government. And I get all the yum-yums, the lithium, the librium, the valium, the yum-yum-yum-yum. One day, I went down there drunk to visit my psychiatrist. and gave him some, I won't even tell you, it's too embarrassing to think I was that crazy. I gave him some story about I was buying the hospital. And if he ever needed help, to come to me, no matter what. He admitted me and classified me on the spot. And he began to get an idea of my true diagnosis. And the last time I was taken in there, I was taken by the police. And I won't get into it. It's a long police report. I don't know how much you can trust that. They found me under a 5-car pileup. And they had to get the jaws of death to get me out. But, of course, I'm so drunk, nothing happens to me. I remember coming to, and I'm in the emergency room at the hospital, and I look under the curtain and I see police feet. Now, I know police feet. I can spot police feet. So I crawl around and I get out. And I hit the road. I don't remember any of this, but apparently I got a taxi driver. I told him my husband had just been killed. That's on the police report. He took me for a bottle of whiskey because I was very nervous. And I was sitting drinking it when the police came to rearrest me. And they immediately took me to Dr. Milliken, who admitted me one more time. And that's when it all came together for me. Because when I was in that time, he said to me, "You're a chronic alcoholic. You certainly have some other things wrong with you. You have an abnormal personality. You know, you certainly suffer from depression." He says, "But you are primarily a chronic alcoholic." He said, "And I will keep admitting you here. I will keep. But one day you're either going to get wet brain, or you're going to kill somebody. If you don't go to AA..." Now, they used to bring AA meetings into the institution, but I never heard anything because I was so full of drugs. But the AA members told me later that they said to me, "Do you have hope?" And I used to say to them, "I have no hope." And I had no hope. I had no hope. I was hopeless. I knew that I was going to go in and out that psych ward on that institution for the rest of my life. And what happened is one night I was, I'd been to court, I'd done all of that, and the judge called me a tragic social circumstance. And I was a tragic social circumstance until I came to you. One night I was drinking myself sober. Has anybody ever been there? What a nightmare. Drinking myself sober. And I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. And a man called Stan came, who had 28 years sobriety. He was a Métis, which means he is Native American, French. And he was a very spiritual man. And he came to me at 3:00 in the morning. And he told me his story. And for the first time in my life, here's me at 40 years old, coming from Glasgow, Scotland, listen to an Aboriginal French talk about the things that I had been thinking and feeling all my life. I got something that for the first time in my life I never knew was available to me, and it was called identification. I got identification, and I got understanding. And he said, "Tell me a bit about you, Mary." And I told him. And he said, "I think you're one of us. I think you're one of us." I may as well share it because I always do, because he made me laugh. I said to him, Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have this psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He says, Mari, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches. They fit any nut that comes through the door. He made me laugh. And I got into AA. And I remember at my first meeting, seeing that on the wall. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. You see, I never had the verbiage. I never had the language to explain to you that first step. And to see it written had a profound effect on me. And it had me want to stay here. Because all I have to do is admit something that's been destroying me and that I thought nobody could ever understand. So when Stan said to me, Mari, do you admit you're powerless over alcohol? Yes, I do. Do you also admit your life's unmanageable when you're drinking and when you're not drinking? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. He said, well, get yourself a sponsor. I heard my greatest, apart from Bill, Bob in the writings, my greatest teacher, the one that has struck my soul most profoundly about this illness of alcoholism, about the illness of alcoholism, is Clancy. Somebody gave me, way back in the day, Clancy said something. He said, if your problem's alcohol, you're not an alcoholic. And conversely, if you're an alcoholic, your problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Because if your problem was alcohol, you'd put the plug in the jug and everything would be beautiful. But if you're suffering what I'm suffering from, then your problem is alcoholism. And that ism opened it up for me. That all of this stuff I had gone through all my life could be fixed by working through these 12 steps. Step 2, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. When I got into AA in Edmonton, it was a tough old crowd I got into. God gives you what you need. And when I got in, they said to me, 90 meetings in 90 days, and if you don't like what you hear, we'll gladly refund you your misery. Get a big book, get a sponsor, get active. You can't talk for a year because you don't know nothing. Just sit and listen. Resign from the debating society. Seek help. Don't keep anything to yourself. I remember I was sitting in a meeting about 6 months sober, and I heard something that I thought could possibly have another slant put to it. And I said, excuse me, I think. And this old timer said, shut up. Who told you to think? Look what thinking got you. Try saying that to somebody today. So, it says here, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Probably alcoholic. You know, in my search for a solution to this thing, before I found AA, I had picked up a book by a man called Jelinek. I don't know if you've ever heard about him. Jelinek, and he talks about the Jelinek arc of recovery and how when people get really, really down and somebody goes and they get some knowledge about why they drink, then they'll start on the upswing. I could never make that upswing. I don't know what happened. But what you're giving me here What you're beginning to give me here is answering my innermost problems, because you see, I lack power. And it tells me in here that lack of power is my dilemma. I can't get power from alcohol anymore because it stopped working for me. And how am I going to, it talks in here about, we're going to have to talk about God. How am I going to, I was born Roman Catholic, into a good Roman Catholic family. My father was a Franciscan monk. He left the monastery for some theological debate. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. I didn't believe in God. I don't know. From age 10, I had a hard time with God. I had my own funny mystical thinking about everything. I remember when I was at school, they used to come at, way back in the day when I was young at school, they used to come and give us vaccinations for various diseases that were going around at the time. And they wanted to give me, in my left arm, they wanted to give me a vaccination. I said to them, you can't vaccinate me there because that's where my soul is. They said, your soul's not in your arm. I said, yes, it is. So they brought the priest. And the priest said to me, your soul's not in your arm. I said, where is it? He says, I don't know, but it's not in your arm. I said, well, you don't know either. I don't know when I began rowing away from God on this great mystical sea that used to be my mind. Rowing away from God. When I used to go to Ireland every year. And in Drogheda, where my family live, some of my family, there's a beautiful old cathedral. And inside that cathedral, they have the head of a martyred saint. He was martyred 300 years ago. His name is St. Oliver Plunkett. And all they have is his head. It was burnt by the English. But so it's a blackened head. But he still has teeth. That fascinated me. You know, in my country, teeth are a rare commodity, you know. And my family used to sit me down in the front row to look at this poor martyred saint that had sacrificed his life for God and for what he believed in and for which I had no reverence for. And my family used to say to me, now I want you to sit down and study St. Oliver Plunkett, because he really loved God. And I'm sitting thinking, if he really loved God and that's what happened to him, I want something more than that. Thank you very much. But you know, they told me that I'll come to believe. That you come to and you come to believe. Something's keeping me sober. What is it? I don't have any idea what it is. I was reading William James one day, The Varieties of Religious Experience, because that's what I used to do. I read everything because I couldn't sleep. And in there, William James had said that a doctor told him once that the radical cure for dipsomania is religiomania. And I believe that was probably Carl Jung who told him that, because Jung wrote a letter in 1948 talking about having a two-hour discussion with William James in 1909 when he came to Clark University. And they said what they discussed was religious experiences. And I thought, religiomania. Well, AA tells me it's not a religion, but it's certainly spiritual. So I went about finding a God of my understanding. And what I began to see and believe is that what was keeping all of you sober, what was giving you the ability to communicate with me on a soul level about the soul disease that had destroyed my life, I wasn't even sober when my parents died. They never knew if I drew a sober breath. I wasn't even there to go and comfort my one little brother. I wasn't there for my children. How am I going to live with that without being unconscious? The only way I'm going to live with that is hooking into this power that's going to give me the ability to do everything I'm asked to do and walking through the rest of the steps. Because my life had been just, it looked like a wasteland after the locusts have come through. That was the image I had. How am I going to fix this? But what I had and what I believe was God-given without me even knowing was I had a desire. Through agony, despair, had grown a desire within me. I believe that it is in the complete and utter despair and agony, the terror, bewilderment, frustration and despair that is active alcoholism, that is chronic alcoholism, that if we're lucky, we get this desire. But you can't just get it from anywhere. There's no spiritual Viagra. Last year, July, in Holland, a 44-year-old man, alcoholic, was granted euthanasia by the Dutch government. He passed all of their criteria for unbearable suffering, with no hope of getting better. He was euthanized as an alcoholic. I think to myself, would I have taken that option if I'd never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous? And on the other hand, I think to myself, how I wish that that poor man, who apparently had gone to 21 treatment centers, you can look it up on, you can Google it, alcoholic euthanized, and had 8 years of help, just found life too much. And maybe there is a place beyond which we go without the power that we find here. Maybe there is a place beyond which we go where we can never come back again. Because when the pain of being sober is greater than the pain of being drunk, then we will drink again. But in order to keep the level of pain down, we have to do the steps until it goes. Until we do the 6th and 7th, the 4th and 5th, until we get all that stuff out. But I will never understand God, because God is anything the intellect is not. If I was to understand God, God wouldn't be greater than me. But I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You see, that had much more meaning for me than just the insanity of the alcohol, drinking the alcohol. I considered myself insane before I drank. And a lot of people thought that I was not right in the head, because they told me, you're not right in the head. On page 49, it talks about where our contention is true that we didn't need a universe. We believe this universe needs no God to explain it. Where our contention is true, it would follow that life originated out of nothing, means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. That concept of nothingness, which to me is a lack of God, is how I had my first panic attack. And I've never told this from the podium. I was sitting listening to something, and suddenly I got an idea. And into my head came the idea that when I die, because I was obsessed with death, I'm going to be in a state of nothingness, conscious, for eternity. A state of nothingness, in consciousness, for eternity. That was a thought I had at 13. And it created great panic in me. And who can you go and talk about that to? I certainly didn't. I believe now it tells me in this book, that word is there, nothingness. Oh my God. So if I believe and do this, then I'll never feel that way. My madness and my craziness about all that will go away. And it did. Everything that's told me in here has come true. I could not believe. I mean, this was such a gift to me. Such a gift when I read this book. To me, step two is the moment between trapezes. You know that moment between trapezes? There's two trapezes, and he lets go of one, and he's going to catch the other one. You can come in and do the first step, but then you got to go, and you got to catch on to the second. And you got to go to the third, and you got to go to the fourth. There's some people today. Well, let me just talk about me. My favorite subject. That's why I was married 4 times but have no idea about communal sex. Because I was always thinking about myself. I don't know what it is to share. I got married in AA and my husband had a massive stroke and he was a long time in care, and then he was in a behavioral center. He had severe global aphasia, which meant he could not talk. He couldn't understand the spoken word. The psychiatrists in the hospital he was in, the behavioral unit, they called me down, and they said, "Mary, we know that alcoholics think differently, that they are extremely sensitive, that they have a different perception of the world than we do. And we were wondering if you would take some little psychiatric tests so that we could get some understanding of the alcoholic mind and how it works." I'm 8 years sober. I'm well. Bring it on. Bring it on. So they give me 3 little books with yes, no answers, a little place to write other stuff in, and very small books, and I give them back. They said to me, "Okay, well, when we have the results, we'll let you know. This will be very helpful." So the next day I got a call asking me to come down. I went into the room, and there's 3 psychiatrists sitting behind a desk with a tape recorder. And as soon as I walk in and they tell me to sit down, their first question to me was, "So who's looking after you now?" I said, "My sponsor." He said to me, "So what medication are you on?" I said, "I haven't been on medication since I got sober, the 10th of August, 1984. They said, "Well, according to these results, you should be." So my advice, don't take any psychiatric tests. The other great thing that, you know, and we agnostics, We agnostics is a great promise about what this power we will find in the second step can do for us. It talks about the bedevilments, you know, having trouble with personal relationships, couldn't control your emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, all of that, feeling a usefulness, feeling a fear, unhappy, couldn't be a help to other people. It says in here, when we saw others solve their problems by simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas didn't work, but the God idea did. As desperate as I was, this was manna from heaven for me. Because only somebody who was suffering from what I was suffering from could write this stuff, because he knew what I needed to live if I wasn't to drink. I never knew any of this stuff would help me. I've been told I'm hopeless. I've been told I'm going to be a retread in psychiatric care for the rest of my life. I'm told I'm a chronic alcoholic with an abnormal personality. The only thing that keeps me together if I'm not drinking is about 5 medications. And that's not for long either, until I have to look for another drink. This is alcoholism. The problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, not the body. The mind is not the brain. You can put the brain under a stethoscope and look at it. You can't put the mind under the brain. The ancient people used to say that the mind was soul. So if the problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, it centers in my soul. And yes, I do need soul surgery. I do need a soul solution. But how do you ever think that if you get back to when you think about what drinking used to do for you? You don't think about soul surgery. You don't think about the solution is God. You don't think about the solution is, you know, making amends, clearing up, admitting your wrongs to people. The second step is an amazing step. But how many times when I've been working with some of the women I work with, and I thank God for them because they help me. They help me so much. Even when I don't feel like picking up the phone, I pick up the phone because I need them more than they need me. But some of the younger ones I've had who keep going out, when I eventually get to work with them, I realize that they don't have a firm grip on step one. So that step two has never ever given them what it gave me, who did a solid, who got the base, the bedrock that is step one. It doesn't matter if you're powerless over other stuff. I can only help you in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're powerless over alcohol. That is the only solution I have. I have a solution to the imbibement of a solution that was destroying your life. When Carl Jung said to wrote to Bill Wilson that, in his opinion, the formula for the alcoholic in Latin is spiritus contra spiritum. That is spirit against spirit. We suffer from a spiritual illness, which is body, mind, spirit, soul, mind, all encompassing. Nothing to do with what we're drinking. Once that's gone, once we stop drinking, then we come face to face with the nature of the problem, which is a lack of God, a lack of morals, like Dr. Sokwa said when he said they thought for a while that alcoholics needed some kind of a moral psychology, but they didn't know how to apply it. A lack of living skill. We lack so much. And if you be like me, my natural habitat is La La Land. I'm a liar. You know, I came from such a good family. And I was born with some kind of a criminal mindset. I don't know why. I was not born with good moral values. So it was very easy to go off on the road I went. So it comes down to this, doesn't it? When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face a proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What is your choice to be? What is your choice to be? Do you want to come here and live the life that we have today? My life today is beyond my wildest dreams. Simply because somebody took the time who suffered from what I was suffering from, called alcoholism, and showed me that there was a way to live. And that I had been living a life without faith. And that because I was so inadequate, I needed something to believe in. And because I had so many mental problems, I needed something that I truly believed in. And that you would give me the solution to all of that, not just my drinking, but to my insanity. Now, I'm not a doctor. I haven't had any medication since the 10th of August, 1984. In the very early years of my sobriety, some people really thought I should be medicated. But here's what the old timers, in their great wisdom, told me. They said, maybe you are manic depressive. Maybe you are, or maybe it's just your alcoholism. But let's see. Because if you're suffering from alcoholism, it can look like manic depression. But the highs will get lower, and the lows will get higher. And every now and then, you'll get a little balance. And that's what began to help. And that I went from trying to be self-sufficient to being God-sufficient. Relying on God for everything. Today, God is everything to me. Because I know that without God, I am nothing. And every morning for the last 34 years, I say all my other prayers and do my little meditation. But I ask God in a very simple way to please keep me sober this day, God. To please keep me sane. And every night when I kneel down, I thank God for keeping me sober this day and for keeping me sane this day. Because this fellowship and this program and these wonderful people that we have in here and these 12 steps and what Bill and Bob gave for us is the greatest antidote to the type of mental illness, whatever the hell it was that I was suffering from. My gratitude is immense, and I want to thank you so much for having me here. Thank you.